the Offside Rule exclusives.
Scoring 152 goals in his 17-year career, striker Bobby Zamora is best known for his time at Brighton and Hove Albion and West Ham United. But he also had spells at three other London clubs, including Fulham, QPR and Spurs. Having grown up in Essex, the Offside Rule went back there to meet the former England international and discuss his achievements, his regrets and his philanthropic nature. I'm joined by Bobby Zamora in a very swanky apartment. I know this is part of your life nowadays, and one of the ventures that you've got into is doing social housing and building and property, something that's been a keen interest of yours.
On the social housing and helping local government side, the Legacy Foundation was set up, myself, Rio Ferdinand and Mark Noble. So, yeah, we're working with local housing associations, with councils to try and create more social housing, but also something for the kids, really. So sports, education, almost like an old school youth centre, really, where you can, after school, I mean, there's that witching hour when you finish school and your parents are at work, maybe, and you've got 3 hours to kill before they get home, and it's trying to have something to entertain the children, to guide the children, put them in a safe environment, really, where they can also learn and play. So we are working hard on it. It's a very slow process, we've learnt, working with councils and government, but it's something that we're determined to do, and it's we're still chugging away and striving for what we want.
How did it come about? Was it your idea?
It was Rio Ferdinand, actually. I mean, I used to share a car into training with Rio, and we got talking about it. Mark Noble's one of my best friends. Just evolved, really. The conversation evolved. Rio had a friend who has a special funding process, which allows councils to benefit. So they can create a revenue stream, they can get a capital receipt, and they also own the asset at the end of it as well. So it's quite unique, quite different to anything they've seen before. So it's a slow process, and trying to convince them that it works for them is slow. But like I say, it's saying that we're working at, and we have success, and we can't wait to have the first one on the ground. But in the background, we have a fantastic team in the charity side of it. Our trustees are amazing. So yeah, they're working hard on where we put these funds and who we can help and how we can help them.
Speaking to you post your football career, so you retired 35. I mean, it does throw up that question about life after football. This is obviously one thing that you've immersed yourself in. When you did retire, was that a difficult point for you to work out what to do next?
Not really. My career, I sort of, with my injuries, so Monday to Friday, normally you'd be out on a Monday and a Tuesday, Wednesday off, train on Thursday, Friday, game on a Saturday. Mine sort of turned out to be just training on a Thursday, maybe. So Monday, Tuesday, I have a lot of time. Obviously, you go to the training ground, you have a laugh and a joke with the boys, then you go out to train. But when it's a long-term injury or a process that you have to do constantly, it's actually becomes quite mentally tough. And it's not what you sign up to do, really, in terms of, you know, the boys go out and train and have all the fun, and you're in the gym doing your exercises that you do constantly. But in that time, I managed to focus on where I was. I mean, obviously, I knew my career was coming to an end. Managed to focus my mind on what I was going to do afterwards, what my passions were, and where I wanted to go. So on the flip side of it, yes, it was hard work as a player, and you want to be playing and training every day. But on the flip side of that, it gave me an opportunity to think about where I was going to go and how I was going to do it.
The landscape has changed quite significantly, not just even in the time that you've retired. So I'm aware now that you can't actually collect any pension investments that you made as a footballer until 55. It used to be 35, which is the year that you would have retired originally.
Yeah, it's a funny old process. I didn't really get too much involved in the pension side of it. I like bricks and mortar myself, so I chose to go down a different route. But yeah, I know some players have got a bit of a wait now until they can access their pensions. Thankfully, like I said, I didn't really go down that route. There's a little bit of money in the pension that's been in there, but something that I don't really depend on.
You do feel that footballers need that element of support nowadays. I mean, we'll come back to what you're doing at the moment, as well as all the property investments and other bits and pieces that you've got going on. That life after football is of interest to people. But let's go back, first of all, because you were born and brought up in Barking. For anyone that doesn't know what that area is like, give us some insight.
It's just like, well, any inner London sort of town, although Barking comes under Essex. I still class it as, it's a London borough, but it still comes under Essex. But it's, yeah, it's like any sort of nitty-gritty borough in London, really. There's good things and bad things about it. Thoroughly enjoyed my upbringing. I lived in Manor Park, which is in Newham. I went to school in Barking, so yeah, got on a bus every day and went to school. But like I say, thoroughly enjoyed it. I suppose it's made me what I am again. And yeah, my kids live a slightly different life, but a little bit for me wishes that they could experience and yeah, have a taste of what I sort of had growing up.
Was it a big footballing part of the world? Did you feel quite lucky to be in an area that took football quite seriously?
Yeah, plenty of boys' clubs, plenty of football teams to join and pitches everywhere. Well, we used to play in between the cars on my road. So, yeah, football was everywhere. Kids, that's all the kids wanted to do. No Minecraft, no iPads, no nothing like that. So it was generally the whole of the area out on the streets in the summer holidays and enjoying themselves. And I think that's why we're trying to do that with the Legacy Foundation, to give somewhere that the kids can go and play and enjoy themselves. And my upbringing was fantastic and enjoyed every moment of it, really did.
And often when you speak to people, there's that one person that breaks through the glass ceiling, because it is a difficult career to get into. But you actually, from a young age, were playing with some big names. I'm just looking down on my list of the sorts of people that you knew very early on: John Terry, Ledley King, Paul Konchesky, some big names.
Yeah, crazy. It's yeah, as a kid, I remember growing up and being told, yeah, you know, maybe one of your sort of peers or yourself may become a professional footballer. But yeah, like you say, looking back now and seeing that five of my Sunday side all went on to play for England, get senior caps, is quite remarkable, really. So yeah, I don't think that'll happen again. But a fantastic boys team, Senrab, we used to play at Wanstead Flats. Lee Bowyer, Jermaine Defoe, Sol Campbell, I think. Those guys were in different ages as well. That all came through there, and yeah, I was lucky to have some great guidance and a great team, and yeah, we're all fortunate enough to have made it to play professional football.
We're not even talking about an academy. I mean, what was it about that place?
I don't know. It was a special place, special team. Like I say, one in a million, no doubt.
And there's not very many footballers that can say as well that they've played for their childhood club, that they've probably dreamt of putting that shirt on. You did that with West Ham. So you lived and breathed West Ham. I'm guessing you've got early memories of going down to the bowling ground.
Yep, I remember going down to the bowling ground, my mum taking me down and going to watch. I think they played Oxford United. It was the first game I ever went to go and see him play. But yeah, I used to go and see Frank McAvenny and George Parris. Those guys were the guys up front. And then when I joined the academy as a kid, we obviously used to get tickets. So every weekend or, you know, every home game, I'd be there and jump on a bus and go down and watch. And all the players in the academy all pretty much sitting with each other and watching the game. So fantastic memories watching West Ham play. And yeah, like you say, to go away, get my opportunity to play football at Brighton. And then have the chance to come back and like you say, run out at Upton Park. I remember my first home game and the crowd singing Bubbles, and obviously I'm singing it as well, hairs on the back of my neck. It was really, really a special day for me, and probably one of my top memories in football.
One of the top memories, because you actually scored in that match. And did you score the winner?
Yeah, I think it was 1-0. But yeah, certainly scored on your home debut. So like I say, it couldn't have gone any better.
Harley turns it deep in again. Can Daly bring it back? It's in there! It's Zamora on his debut!
Mentally, what were you going through then? Because is that something where you're extra pumped up because it's a team that means so much to you? Or are you having to pull back and say, don't get too carried away with this, don't get too emotionally invested?
I always think to myself that I'm quite level-headed or don't really take too much attention to hype or anything like that. But yeah, that game that day I can remember was quite emotional for me. Like I say, going out Upton Park and the hairs on the back of my neck, that, you know, I'd played for a few years professionally and never really had that experience at all. But to do that, that was the one day, certainly for me, that stands out.
You saying about singing I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, it's interesting, the song thing, because I feel like watching you growing up and watching football in the era that you played in, you were probably the footballer that had the most chance about you. Just up and down, whether it be Brighton, West Ham, Fulham, QPR, there was always a song. Is that to do with your name? Because it's just... it's poetic, is it?
Yeah, possibly. I'm not a songwriter, but yeah, like you say, there is a few songs, and yeah, I've been quite fortunate enough to be able to hear that out on the pitch. And like you say, as a kid, you dream of that sort of thing, and to have that happen is very special. And yeah, a few songs. So.
Do you still get them sung at you occasionally?
Yeah, every now and then. Yeah, yep. So some good, not so good, sir. But no, fantastic, great memories.
You've had quite a significant part to play in playoff finals during your career. I'm imagining that that's sort of a whole other level of atmosphere when there's so much at stake.
Yeah, big occasions. First one, we didn't actually win, West Ham Palace at Cardiff. And we lost that game.
It's Andrew Johnson, more than capable of scoring, and he very nearly did, and Neil Shipperley has! And Crystal Palace score first in the First Division playoff.
Next year we bounced straight back into the final and, yeah, managed to score a winning goal in that one. So, fantastic to take, like you say, the team that you support, back up into the Premier League. That's what I went there for. I signed from Spurs in the Premier League, went to West Ham in a Championship, and that was the aim, to get West Ham in the Premier League, and managing to score that winning goal, like you say, another very, very special goal for me, and a tremendous feeling.
Zamora! And Queen's Park Rangers have won it! Bobby Zamora played into his path and has jabbed it in! The 10 men are ahead! It's another Bobby Dazzler from Zamora. It's Derby County 0, Queen's Park Rangers 1. 3 minutes of added on time to go. Would you believe it? No! Unbelievable!
This is the Offside Rule from Muddy Knees Media.
Manager-wise, who was it that you really enjoyed playing under?
Do you know what? I've been quite lucky. A lot of managers had a lot of faith in me. So I've been very fortunate to have, you know, Mickey Adams at the start, Steve Coppell, Peter Taylor, who managed to get us in the under-21 side with his experience of international football. Yeah, Pards, Glenn Hoddle obviously signed me for Spurs. You know, what a fantastic player Glenn was, and to have somebody with that much knowledge and experience to actually want to splash the cash as such and take a gamble on somebody that's played their football at the lower leagues as such would be special. But Roy Hodgson probably for me is the best manager at the time. We played with him, and his sessions were very regimented, and we'd do pretty much the same session every single day. And at the time, you think, bloody hell, this is boring. It's so frustrating. You just want to go and express yourself and have some fun. But Roy would drill his teams in where the balls should be going, the movements the players should make. And it's only now that you look back and you realise that's why we got to a European Cup final. That's why we beat Manchester United. That's why we beat Arsenal. That's why we beat, you know, all the big teams. And like you say, getting to a European Cup final for a club that isn't massive is special. And that happened because we had one, we had a great set of players, good players, talented players. But also we had Roy Hodgson who organised and pretty much told us what we should be and should and shouldn't be doing now, and where the ball could and couldn't go. I mean, I generally could have played left back in that team because I knew exactly where the players were going to move. and vice versa, and everyone knew their roles.
Do you believe he still manages like that now at Crystal Palace?
I don't think he's probably got another way, to be honest. It's brought him a lot of success all his career, so I don't see why it should change.
And for you now going into coaching, is that something that you take from him? Because you look at the modern day footballer, and actually the argument might be quite the contrary, that they want variety, you know, keep changing things, keep them thinking ahead, because actually that mundane feeling might be something that they're trying to escape, but actually it might have its benefits.
Yeah, no doubt. Of course, everyone's different, their coaching techniques, their management styles, but certainly from my experience and what Roy done and how he done it, I think, yes, as a kid, you obviously need to learn and experience so many different ways. As a professional, it's very different. I think we were an experienced bunch of lads, really, that have been playing at the top level for a while. So I think that side of it, yeah, structuring and how he wants to deliver and how he has his perception of how he wants to play is fine. But, yeah, certainly as kids, you want to go and have some enjoyment and learn different techniques. So, yeah, changing managers, change coaches, change of venue, scenery, all those bits and pieces will enhance every player, no doubt.
I'm speaking to you when I look at your England international career, two senior caps, and I'm thinking, well, if Gareth Southgate had been the manager when you were on the scene, you probably would have got a lot more, because he's obviously given newer players a chance. Back when you were playing, it was so much more difficult to get that first nod, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It took me a while to get it, to be fair. But my international career was fantastic. I enjoyed going, being with the squad. I don't know how many times I was there, 12, 15 maybe. So experiencing and playing with the likes of Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard, you know, for a couple of weeks was fantastic. Obviously, I missed out on the World Cup due to injury. Fabio Capello phoned me to ask me if you know, I could go to South Africa. We just had the European Cup final. I probably shouldn't have played in that. I played and needed an operation, came off just after half-time, I think. So, yeah, when Fabio Capello tells you, look, once you've come to the World Cup, and having to say no, that's my only regret in football, actually, is saying no because I needed an operation. And in my mind, I just thought, if I went to the World Cup, would I train? Probably not, because I needed to rest my Achilles. If I wasn't training, would I be selected? Probably not, because you'll have three or four other strikers there. So in my mind, it was just go, get it done, and be sorted for next season. Now, looking back, I probably should have been selfish and experienced the World Cup, really.
Are there certain injuries, I suppose especially positionally as a striker as well, that you know you might not ever be the same afterwards?
The way I played football towards the end of my career, or certainly my time at Fulham, I think injury-wise, I could have dealt with it. I mean, I was not electric. So I think that's one of the main parts. If you pick up an injury, you're going to have that lightning pace that some players do have. For myself, it was being a big, strong target man. So the lightning pace wasn't actually needed too often. So for myself, I just carried on, just stayed strong, stayed in the gym, worked on my strength, and that became a big part of my game.
Very recently, we've just had an anniversary. I think it was 2007 when West Ham relegated Sheffield United and you got Tevez in the team. And you must have seen all those articles quite recently. What was that like at the time when Tevez and Mascherano were unveiled? And you must have watched the World Cup. Talking about World Cups, you'd have seen them playing for Argentina and thought, what's going on here?
I remember the first day they came in. I didn't actually know too much about them. They were, obviously big name players. It just felt quite distant. They felt quite, because they weren't European, they weren't playing in Europe. I think they obviously huge stars in their own right in South America. But when they came to England, it was like, who are these guys? What are they all about? But certainly after the first day or two and seeing them in training, I certainly understood that, you know, all the hype and what it was all about.
And company and people owned. So these are players. It was the first time we'd heard of that.
Yeah, I didn't really understand what that was all about. But to be honest, not my issue, not my problem. Just wanted to carry on playing football. Two new players, and that's all it was. If the paperwork's done correctly, incorrectly, it was nothing to do with me. didn't know the ins and outs of the deal, so you just put your faith in the club lawyers and doing what they do. So didn't even cross my mind, to be honest.
So in the dressing room, it doesn't really affect players, because you do wonder whether there's those chats that happen and it's like, well, what's happened here and what does that mean for us?
No, I don't even think at the end of the season, even when we were playing Sheffield United, all of that, I don't think we even spoke about it. It was just get on, do the game and win the game, and that's going to put Sheffield United to bed, nothing else.
It did announce them to the world. I mean, did you realise the sort of talents that they were straight away?
Yeah, obviously, as soon as you can tell when players come into a club, you know, in the first keep ball session, whether they've got enough or what sort of player they are. And yeah, fantastic players. Mascherano only played a couple of games for us. Hayden Mullins kept him out of the team, but a lot of people think, you know, that's ridiculous. But Hayden was a very, very special player. He was a get it, give it, under the radar, 7 out of 10 every week, who understood the Premier League. So the players that play with him understand that. Mascherano, fantastic, unbelievable player. Great work ethic. When we used to finish training and he wasn't playing, he would be straight in the gym on the treadmill, pounding it for 45 minutes. So he knew exactly where he wanted to be, what he wanted to do. And he got his move to Liverpool, and he was fantastic. But yeah, amazing lad. Wanted to learn English straight away. Tevez, on the other hand, not so much, but a fantastic character, good guy, and again, gave it all on the pitch.
Given the players that you're friends with, I wonder if you less gravitated towards sort of flair players, if you like, and more to those real hard workers, the grafters in the team, you know, your Mark Nobles, your Rio Ferdinands that you're in business with. They've not for one minute would ever, you know, not run through a wall for the team, would they?
Those guys, yeah, I mean, they're fantastic players, fantastic people. But yeah, probably, yeah, my friends that I've stayed in contact with are probably the workhorses, are probably the people that you know when you say something to them or they say something to you, it's honest and it's correct. So, whereas, yeah, I'm not saying flair players are liars, but I don't know, you know exactly what you're going to get from certain people, and those are the people that I've certainly kept in contact with.
So post-football, you went to be a club ambassador as well for Brighton and Hove Albion. Natural fit, given what you achieved there. I mean, I'm no mathematician, but the fact that you got 84 goals in 168 appearances means a goal every other game, pretty good statistic.
Yeah, like I say, I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. Absolutely loved it. Both periods. First period, obviously, gave me the opportunity to play football, and I was lucky enough, like you say, to score a lot of important goals and help the club to two automatic promotions and championship wins. So fantastic times, and going back, sort of ending my career there, just missed out on promoting to every division. That would have been on goal difference is a real kick in the teeth. But that second period, yes, frustrated injury wise, but I think I still managed 10 goals for them, and scoring on my second return to the club, on the debut, second debut almost, I suppose, at Leeds United, scoring a winning goal last 10 minutes. That was a great feeling as well, being able to do that.
For anyone who's not so aware, what does the club ambassador role involve? Is this you constantly doing interviews on behalf of the club, entertaining, hosting people?
I do a few bits and pieces. I don't find myself wanting to over sort of put myself out there, Brighton everywhere. Do you know what I mean? I actually just want to help the club. I went to West Ham. Actually, I went to Brighton West Ham ladies game the other day. Fantastic to see the women's game progressing and seeing the clubs, West Ham and Brighton ladies team really, really kicking on now. And that game's and the club itself is growing. So being involved in that, being involved in a little bit in the community stuff, doing some stuff at some of the home games. But just thoroughly enjoying it, really, still being in there and around the club, a club that means so much to me.
You've got daughters as well, so did you take them along to watch?
I took one of them, yeah, one of the girls that's into footy. She went to watch that and knows one or two of the female players now, so she's close with Laura Rafferty, who's currently injured, unfortunately. But yeah, it's nice for her to see those girls on their stage and performing. And we've just come back from Dubai doing our footballscapes, and she's had a fantastic week doing that as well.
Is that the one thing that's missing now in the comparison between men's and women's, is that time with the fans? The fact that at the end of the match, they're there over in with the fans giving autographs, selfies. Mm. It feels like there's that personal touch there in women's football still.
There is no doubt, but I don't think you'd be able to do it with 60,000 people. But yeah, the women's game certainly is kicking on at present, and the World Cup just gone. I probably watch more of the women's games than the men's games in the World Cup. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it says a lot. It's really great, and it's great to see. Like I say, one of my daughters absolutely loves it now. Come back from holiday, Dad, need to find me a club. So, yeah, it's great, it really is.
Let's talk about coaching. How did that come onto your radar? Was it something that when you were playing you thought you might one day get into, or has it been more of an evolution?
It's a bit of an evolution, to be honest. Coaching professionally, an absolute no for me. I think just the pressure in terms of owners, fans, media, it is 24/7. As a player, you do your training from 10, you start at 10, you're at home by 2:30, 3 o'clock. As a manager, as a coach, it's just non-stop bombarded with everything from everyone, and you can't escape from it. So as a player, I used to go home, switch off from football, just not really watch too much when I was playing. I likened it to a painter and decorator. If you go in and you're painting walls and you're doing this, that and the other all day, you don't go home and first thing you do, put changing rooms on, do you? Do you know what I mean? That's the way I liken it. I like to switch off from football and didn't watch it. But I watch a lot more football now. But I wouldn't want to be a coach in the Premier League in a professional game.
You still can't escape it now, though, because you switch it on and Dion Dublin's on the telly, isn't it?
Yeah, he's in changing rooms. There you go, sir. But yeah, he's... for me, just as I say, professional coaching isn't the avenue, but certainly having fun, laughing, giggle with the kids, that's more my thing.
So you're not someone, even though you've scored many occasions and got the glory, but you're not after the glory here?
No, I don't. No, it's not for me. It's not for me. And never really has been. So it's not something that I find myself wanting to go into.
You've done a lot of badges now, so where are you up to?
No, just a B, so that's all.
And you're happy to stay there?
Don't want to go any further. As I say, that's just needed for the elite boys, and I'm fine with that.
And are there many other footballers that you know that have got a similar outlook to it and want to just remain at B? And
yeah, I think so. Like I say, it's just consuming. It really is. It's non-stop. It seems to be getting bigger and bigger. The media side of it is just frightening, really. It's everywhere. Everyone's got their phones and their cameras, and all those bits and pieces of football today is a bit off-putting, I think, for a lot of players, and certainly players that are coming towards the end of their career and not really wanting to be involved in that side of it.
I was going to say that you must have plenty of phone calls from people wanting you, managers, to come and work with their strikers. However, I'm wondering, is that the case? Because the sort of striking role that you had isn't as fashionable anymore, is it? That player that holds up play and lays off the ball and, like you say, a bit more of a target man. But you see these things work in circles, it might come around again.
No doubt. I think, you know, I think there's certainly a place for a target man as such in every team. And if you speak to a lot of the let's say short, sharp, quick, explosive players up front, they like playing with someone that's going to take those hits and give them that opportunity on the edge of the box when that ball does come in. So it's certainly a position and a role that is never going to disappear, I think.
We've spoken about some of your favourite memories. I just wondered what else springs to mind when you look back collectively over your career, because obviously there's the promotions, there's the scoring on debuts, but are there any particular games that you relive very vividly?
Probably the Fulham Juventus game at home in the Europa League, 3-1 down away from home, and needing obviously a big win against a team that, you know, World Cup winner Cannavaro, Del Piero, Trezeguet, Felipe Melo. It was just an unbelievable side, and conceding within the first couple of minutes to make it 4-1 to them on aggregate, and having to come back and produce something very, very special, which we did. And for me, managing to score in that game and being a part of that evening at Craven Cottage was probably the most special night, I think, in my career. I just spoke to someone the other day, and it's 10-year anniversary this year. So I believe that Fulham are going to try and get the team together, and which will be nice because some of the boys haven't seen for a while. But that probably is an outstanding moment and a night that's, yeah, like you say, quite vivid in my mind.
And now you've got to believe it! A night beyond compare! Old Father Thames has never seen the like!
The Offside Rule Exclusives.
Lots of different journalists that I work with, when you ask about the grounds that you like to go to, Craven Cottage is one of the first that people say. I think it's probably the tradition, isn't it? And the wooden seats and that old atmosphere.
Just the place is fantastic. Like you say, the old listed cottage, which is beautiful. The wooden seats, yeah. I mean, obviously they've got the development there now and building the new stand, which should enhance the river side of it, you know, what a fantastic view and location that is. But yeah, I remember signing for Fulham. One of the first things I had to do was go to the club shop. I'd just come from West Ham in East London. I'd gone to Fulham, who was obviously owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed and Harrods. And in the club shop, obviously signing a few bits and pieces, when they opened the doors, they had people there with trays of champagne for the people coming in, and I remember thinking, this is so weird coming from East London, whereas if you'd have done that, the whole of East Ham would have been down and taking those bottles of champagne. But it was eye-opening, and what a fantastic club.
That's the difference between East and West London, clearly.
Well, Al-Fayed's view of it, yeah, certainly. I mean, he was a fantastic owner. Really was, and done little special things like that for the fans.
Owners nowadays, they seem to be some from afar, managing from countries abroad and being more like a business venture, and some more hands-on, coming down to the dressing room after a result. I mean, what did you prefer as a player?
I quite liked them being at the ground, being at the games and seeing and understanding, whereas some of those owners that are very busy people for one, and are all around the world doing bits and pieces. But for me, I quite like those owners being at the ground and seeing and experiencing it and knowing firsthand what your investment's doing and how the players are performing, really, and not just getting it third hand and being told by somebody else, making their own mind up about decisions.
I hope you don't mind me asking about this, but it's quite topical at the moment with the racism in football, the way that Raheem Sterling has been quite a spokesman for it, Tyrone Mings, who handled his England debut really well. And there is more of a spotlight on it now. And I just wondered, when you played, if that had caused any problems for you.
Do you know what? Not so much, really. I can probably only think of a couple of occasions where I've experienced it myself, but football done the talking, and I think I vaguely remember the two games, winning the games, scoring in one of them, and that sort of being my what have you got to say now, sort of hand to ear sort of thing, really. So just ignoring and getting on with it. But yeah, now, I mean, obviously Tyrone Mings and the England setup and what they done the other night was fantastic, there's no place for it. Raheem Sterling, top of the game for me. He's probably one of the best players in the world for me by far, and how he's dealt with everything. And to be honest, he's had the media on his back for a long, long time for all sorts of stupid reasons, from tattoos and interpreting what a tattoo means instead of asking, or, you know, just things like that. But Raheem's been fantastic. He's helped and dealt with everything so well, and long may it continue for him.
I think the press as well in this country, when we pick up newspapers and things happen like that, when England were on international duty, it's very quick to point the finger abroad. Do you think more needs to be done here?
Yeah, I think so. It does, but it's going to be a slow process, and the, the likes of John Barnes and Rossignol and all those guys that experienced it on a week-to-week basis in England can see the progress that's been made, and in England the progress will be made and continue. So we're doing very well here. Yes, the rest of the world still does need to catch on, and what England done the other day and is in the right process and the right steps for educating everybody else.
A podcast that I like to listen to is called How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, completely unfootball related. But considering that you brought up earlier in the conversation that, you know, you had a regret about not taking that opportunity with England, with Fabio Capello and South Africa, and I wondered whether, given the influence that you can have as a footballer nowadays, whether there was anything you regretted not speaking out about, whether there was something, you know, you've just mentioned as well that you've been to women's football recently. Maybe that was something that was a little ignored.
Regrets. I don't think I have too many. Kyle, you sprung that one on me.
It's easy to think, isn't it? When I listen to that podcast, when I'm usually driving to matches,
yeah,
and people always give three things that they failed at. You know, if I threw that at you, you know, what would you say you failed in, and how it made you a better person?
I don't like to fail, so probably more England games, probably more England caps, but yeah. Regret, maybe. When I was at Fulham, Roy Hodgson left, went to Liverpool. They came in for me. Spurs at the same time, January transfer window, Harry Redknapp, Roy Hodgson both bidding. Al Fayed being Al Fayed said no. But maybe I should have dealt with it differently. Maybe I should have done what I've seen other people do. And get the move that they want, but maybe that's a regret. But thoroughly enjoyed my time at Fulham and stayed there and enjoyed it. So maybe that would be one regret, not being able to go to Liverpool, Spurs at the top time. Probably Liverpool would have been the one. Yeah.
And I suppose because they are a club that are world renowned as well, they've got so many international fans as well as here, and the fact that they're doing so well again, maybe it would have been nice to be part of that history.
Yeah, it possibly, but again, that's if buts and maybes, isn't it? But yeah,
you did play against them in the FA Cup final.
Yeah, played against them a few times in my career and scored a couple of goals. So yeah, you know, Anfield's an amazing place, and just walking down the tunnel and touching this in Anfield, you know, the history behind that is fantastic, and what a place, what a club.
Just to round this off, we've obviously spoken about life after football. You're involved in property, you've still involved in businesses with footballers, doing this coaching at that B level. What else for you?
Those are my passions, probably. The foundation I've got with Mark and with Rio, a property development company that I do myself as well. And investments here and there, and again, football escapes, really, which my kids love, and going away, going to some fantastic places and enhancing some people's holidays and some kids' holidays and giving them real unique experiences. We just come back from Dubai, and Michael Owen, you know, sharing his wealth of knowledge with 5 to 15-year-olds on holiday is fantastic, and I would have loved to experience that as a kid myself.
Every time there's a new announcement in terms of Strictly Come Dancing, I'm a Celebrity, get me out of here, there's a part of me that thinks, I wonder if one day Bobby Zamora's name might come up.
None of those ones. Do you know what I would like to do? I'd like to do The Island.
Oh,
Bear,
yeah.
Grylls.
Yeah.
That's what I would love to do. I love the outdoors. I go fishing. I love that sort of outdoor escape sort of thing, and that's a real challenge. And it's for a great cause as well, the guys that do it, the Celebrity Island. So if anyone's listening, if anyone can help me on that front, definitely I'd love to give that a go and a hell of a challenge as a person.
Did you see Wayne Bridge on that?
Yeah, I see Bridgie on his soldier thing. That's, yeah, unique, and he's done amazing. He's done amazing. Well, good for the footballers as well, you know, get a lot of stick normally, and yeah, great to see that Bridgie's give us a great account of ourselves.
And the legs would still hold up?
I don't know about all that running, but the island I'd be able to do, and surviving on a jungle, I'd like to think I'd be all right on that front.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for speaking to us at The Offside Rule. Great to get you on and to get your insight.
Pleasure.
The Offside Rule is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.